You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Welcome to an extra special edition of the FQXI podcast, where we're celebrating the 10th birthday of, well, us, the Foundational Questions Institute.
Which means that we're old enough to have developed our own identity, but we're still at that cute stage before moody adolescence, when you have to worry about us taking up smoking, dating, and trying to borrow your car.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, Brendan. FQXI was launched a decade ago in May 2006 by cosmologists Max Tegmark at MIT and Anthony Aguirre at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We'll be hearing from Aguirre in a moment to find out what their goal was, the ups and downs the Institute has faced, and his favourite research project funded by FQXI.
You know, I've always wondered what the point of FQXI is, so it will be good to finally find out.
Indeed. But before we bring him in, let's take a quick look at some of the recent news in foundational physics. First up, in May, FQXI member Pan Jianwei of the Chinese Academy of Sciences announced that, in July, China plans to launch the world's first quantum communications satellite.
Quantum physicists have already set up ultra-secure communication links here on Earth that exploit quantum quarks to thwart hackers. These use the fact that when you look at a quantum system, you inevitably disrupt it in some way. So quantum communications can be encoded in such a way that if an eavesdropper intercepts them, they will immediately trip an alarm.
Pan was quoted in the Mirror newspaper saying, "The Edward Snowden case has told us that the information in the transmission networks are exposed to risks of being monitored and being attacked by hackers." That was his explanation for the need for a global quantum-secured network.
If the launch goes ahead, it means that China will have won the quantum space race against Europe and the US. So well done. We'll be keeping a watch to see what happens in July, and we will keep you posted.
In other space news, also in May, NASA announced that the Kepler Planet Hunting Telescope had discovered another 1,284 planets orbiting around stars. As reported by Smithsonian, they were able to speed up their hunt thanks to a new statistical analysis technique that helps them quickly identify planetary candidates. And actually, they have another 1,327 candidates up their sleeve that they think are likely to be planets too, but still need to be verified.
Speaking at a press conference, Paul Hertz, director of NASA Headquarters Astrophysics Division, said, "We now know that exoplanets are common and that a reasonable fraction of the stars in our galaxy has potentially habitable planets. Knowing this is the first step toward addressing the question of, are we alone in the universe?"
But how useful is this information? Are we now suffering from planet fatigue, hearing about more and more of these things? Even if they are habitable, how likely are we to actually ever be able to visit them?
Someone who might hope to have an answer is Russian billionaire Yuri Milner. We've talked about his physics initiatives on the podcast in the past. He supports the Breakthrough Prizes, which now dish out more cash per prize than the Nobels, and have honored quite a few of FQXI's own members. Last year, he launched Breakthrough Listen, a SETI project to search for signs of extraterrestrial life. In April, he and Stephen Hawking announced plans to send mini-spacecraft to our nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, that's roughly 4 light-years away. These nanocraft would be equipped with tiny sails. Lasers shot from Earth would strike the sails, powering the craft onwards. Milner's putting $100 million into the mission for research and development.
Since his announcement, Milner's received some criticism over whether the plan is feasible within the proposed time frame of 40 to 50 years. But then, in May, U.S. Congressman John Culberson called for NASA to look into its own mission to Alpha Centauri to launch in 2069, marking the 100th anniversary of the moon landings. This brings up interesting questions about how large-scale projects in foundational physics should be funded. By individuals and charitable foundations, or by governments?
A good person to ask about this, and the Kepler Hall, would be cosmologist and FQXI's director Anthony Aguirre. Since FQXI is charitably funded and was set up to support projects that might miss out on funding from more traditional sources.
And indeed, I did address those funding issues with Aguirre when I spoke to him earlier. We began by first discussing FQXI's history, development, successes, and challenges. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. I think this is your first time on the FQXI podcast. That's not good. You should have been on it before.
I can't believe it's been going on for so long and I haven't been here, so I'm happy to make restitution finally.
And speaking of going on for so long, we're celebrating 10 years of FQXI. So I guess my first question is, do you feel old now?
Well, it's interesting. FQX was born at about the same time as my first son. So I've kind of watched both of them grow to age 10 together.
Yeah, which one misbehaves the most?
FQX is far better behaved. It's far better behaved and much less recalcitrant.
I guess we actually haven't talked about this on the podcast at all, so it's time to ask, how did FQXI come about? What's actually the point of it? What's it trying to do?
There's kind of the outward manifested aim of FQX, which was to bring funding and attention and support to these really deep, interesting, big questions, you know, that often got sidelined for various reasons that were unrelated to their validity or interest, sort of sociological or funding or what have you reasons. So we felt like there are a lot of researchers who were in that boat, that they got into physics with these questions in mind, these big, interesting, deep questions about the world. And then they feel like the years go on, they get to think about those questions less and less. The happiest thing that I've seen with FQX is in some sense not the actual research that's come out of it, although that's been super interesting, but is more the feeling of community that I think it's generated between the conferences, the membership, all these individual meetings that happen. I really feel like there's just a more welcoming environment somehow for a certain type of person who really likes to think about these big questions, and that there's less of a demarcation between the topics that you're allowed to think about and the topics that you're not.
When you talk about this sense of community, is it a sense of community that's being fostered between, you know, physicists or other researchers who felt they weren't able to answer these questions and now they can? And now I guess they've got some kind of like self-help group where they can talk about these questions unashamedly with each other. Or is it extending beyond that to, I don't know, the other funders or the university administration or, you know, the people higher up who maybe would have frowned on them perhaps going off in these directions? I mean, you know, how far does that community extend?
You know, I don't think it's sort of like Kleptomaniacs Anonymous, where you get to talk with the other people who are sort of ostracized from society, but you've got your own little niche group. That's not the goal. The goal very much has been to extend the reach of kind of conventional scientific thinking into new territories and keep the quality and keep the rigor, but expand the territory. And I think that has largely happened in the sense, you know, thinking about, say, the multiverse or foundations of quantum mechanics or information theory and thinking about physics through the lens of information. These are all things that when FQX started were pretty fringy. And now there's pretty much a continuum between the sort of mainstream research in physics departments and what the fringiest FQX researchers are thinking about.
Coming down to kind of the particular grants or the particular research areas that have been funded by FQX, can you pick out an area where you think, yes, you know, if we hadn't funded that particular research project, maybe we wouldn't have seen the kind of results that have happened?
Probably my favorite. So I had, you know, every year we have new grad students come in, and there are two grad students who started talking to me who were super interested in shape dynamics.
Oh.
And this is a theory generated by Julian Barber and collaborators like Flavio Mercati that I think it's safe to say simply would not have happened, certainly not have developed in the way that it did without the FQX support. And now, you know, I have actual students who are coming to me interested in working on this thing, and I have to kind of figure out, like, boy, am I going to learn enough about shape dynamics to actually try this? Maybe, because, you know, it's really interesting. So I would say that seeing that evolve from kind of there's this kind of interesting guy off doing his own thing, thinking about this Machian interpretation of general relativity, you know, to having grad students come to me and say, this is this really cool thing, could we work on this? That, I think, is something that simply wouldn't have happened. And I think there are other instances like that, but that's maybe my favorite, because it's particularly clear that without that support, I think it wouldn't have happened.
So I've asked you about all of the, you know, the positive things and the successes, but over the past 10 years, what have been the sort of the challenges or the things where you've had to kind of rethink or say, okay, maybe this isn't working, maybe we should try something else?
FQX has been nicely funded, and we're super grateful to the Templeton Foundation for its continued support. So that has been just wonderful, and working with them has been completely pleasurable and non-problematic, which was a positive surprise. I would say that the less positive thing is that it's, you know, maybe unsurprisingly difficult to find people to give millions of dollars to fund abstract physics research.
Well, I'm going to step away from sort of congratulating ourselves here for a minute and just say, let's just talk quickly while I have you here about what's been happening over the past month or so. And there have been some sort of interesting spacey type things that I'd like your opinion about. One of them is that NASA announced that Kepler had found about 1,000 more exoplanets. And then sort of on a theme with that, Yuri Milner, the internet billionaire who loves physics and keeps, you know, putting money into physics, announced a project to send tiny little spacecraft to Alpha Centauri. Let's just talk about, you know, how exciting are both of these announcements?
It's nice that you've packaged them together there, I think, because there's, on the one hand, just this growing sense that the galaxy is kind of out there full of interesting stuff. Whether it's full of interesting life is a big open question, but it's, I think it does change the psyche a little bit and make you really start to think, okay, suppose we survive the next 100 years of life on Earth or so, you know, and are able to really do some amazing technological things. That galaxy is out there waiting for us. And can we do some thinking about that? And it's funny with the Starshot. So I was giving a class in the fall, and just kind of on a lark, I decided, because I'd been reading about, you know, going to colonizing Mars in the news, I decided, well, let's take a kind of fun problem to provide the core of this class, which is, how could we get out and colonize the galaxy? And I kind of quickly worked out that you can't use rockets. There's nothing really plausible in terms of getting big, heavy things out there, but sending little tiny things by accelerating them from some outside mechanism, maybe. And I dug up some old papers, and I thought, wow, this is really hard, but this is not impossible. And I got an undergrad student, and she started doing a little bit of research on it. And then a couple months later, this thing appears in the news, and, you know, it's suddenly the worst undergraduate project ever. from obscurity and fringy, it suddenly became completely mainstream with, you know, hundreds of high-skill PhDs working on it. So her undergraduate project was kind of squashed. Oh. But it was really exciting, you know, because I'd been thinking about it to see, wow, this just went from something that is like of almost pure academic interest because no one's ever going to do this to, wow, this, you know, might crash and burn, but this might actually happen. You know, there's nothing like $100 million to lay a nice foundation for something scientifically.
But I guess, you know, a question that sort of comes to mind, and this then relates back to FQXI, we have these foundations or these philanthropists or, you know, individuals who are putting in huge amounts of money sometimes to promote science research, particularly physics research or foundational physics research. And you spoke at the beginning about how you're trying to fill a gap because that wasn't really something that was being met by funding agencies. But, you know, when people step in to do this, is that taking governments off the hook and saying, it's okay, you really don't need to worry about this now because, you know, there are a handful of people who have lots and lots of money, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs and whatever, and they're going to be taking care of this. So, you know, forget about it. It's being taken care of.
Yeah, I think that's a major problem, really. There has to be something providing the bulk of the money, and that really, I think, has to be the federal government. It's not going to work with a sort of strange composite of powerful individuals doing what interests them, it's great, and I think it's a positive thing, but it simply isn't a replacement. And I think, you know, with all due respect to Yuri Milner, I think the initiatives he's done are very positive. They're very much not the way that, you know, I would have spent the money if it were my money. To have that sort of individual iconoclastic view control all the things that happen in the field of fundamental research would be a big mistake. You know, society has a huge interest in this, and it should be society and the representatives of society in the form of our government that sort of defines really what the broad brush goals and where the large amounts of money are going.
Should I ask you what you would have done with the money? I mean, I assume you wouldn't have just put it all into FQXI, or you know, is that a simple answer? Or would there be, you know, is there something else that you're looking at?
I should say I might have actually funded the Starshot at some lower level because I really like that one. But I wouldn't have funded it because I wanted to do it. I would have funded it because an organization that I was a part of, like FQX, thought through many different possibilities, weighed them against each other, and decided to do that. So, you know, you said surely you wouldn't give it all to FQX, but a big chunk of it I would have, you know, because I and Max have worked hard to create something that we feel like has been optimized by us to kind of have a large impact in the stuff that we care about. So I couldn't think of a better source personally in my completely biased view.
All right. Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much. And congratulations again. It's been 10 years.
Well, yes, I wanted to thank you for just the spectacular job. You know, I think you brilliantly toil away bringing all this interesting content to the community site and sort of running it largely without much, frankly, effort from the FQX administration, which I think is perfect. And you've done a fantastic job, and I just wanted to commend you for it. And don't you dare cut this out of the interview.
Oh. I was going to, but thank you very much. Thank you. That's really sweet.
That was FQXI's director, Anthony Aguirre, chatting with Zia. The one major thing I took away from that is that Aguirre calls us FQX, and we say FQXI. Should we tell him it's got an I on the end?
Best to just leave it, I think.
It was nice the way that he thanked you for your work with FQXI, Zia. Though I can't help feeling he forgot to mention someone else important.
I know. I thought the same thing. He obviously meant to express his gratitude to our managing director, Kavita Rajana, too.
Yes, that would be well-deserved. But perhaps someone else, someone right here.
I'm teasing you, Brendan. Of course, Anthony Aguirre is grateful to you, too, and would have said so if you'd been the one interviewing him. But if it helps, I shall invite FQXI's other director, Max Tegmark, on, and he can thank you directly.
Oh yes, will that be on the next edition?
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of the 20th anniversary podcast.
Okay, seems fair. We're putting more information about Pan Jianwei's quantum communications satellite announcements, the Kepler Planet Hall, and an interview that Zia conducted with Yuri Milner for Science Magazine, on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
I'm also going to be adding a link to a past podcast interview with SETI founder Frank Drake, who spoke to me last year about Milner's search for alien life. There's also links to more about Aguirre's favourite FQXI grant winner, Julian Barber, in case you want to know more about his research. Aguirre's not the only one that loves Barber. I've been putting together a page showcasing the most popular articles, videos, podcast segments, blog posts, and essays from FQXI's first 10 years. And Barber features high in almost every category.
He should run for president. And if Aguirre got you interested in FQXI's mission in general, we'll also post a link to the FQXI website on the FQXI website.
Yeah, that seems redundant.
Okay, forget that one.